In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, amen. Direct, O Lord, all our actions by thy holy inspirations and carry them on by thy gracious assistance, sort of a prayer and work of ours. May begin from thee and by thee, be happening through Christ our Lord. Amen. Virgin most prudent, pray for us. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, amen. Okay, today's conference is on actually three virtues. The first is synesis. Nome, and the second one is Nome, and the third one is Epikaia, because there's some misunderstanding. I've even noticed that a little bit in reading some traditionalists talk about Epikaia in relationship to things like, do the SSPX have faculties and things of that sort outside the ones that the Holy Father has granted. So there's a bit of misunderstanding about that virtue. It's not a grave misunderstanding. It's just a little bit off on how they tend to understand it. But the reason I want to go into is these are all virtues that are connected to prudence. And so we'll see that in a little bit. Given our current situation in the world, that is with the whole COVID lockdown, the appearance that some people are using this to make political hay out of it. Also questions about how dangerous the thing is and things like that, and the fact that the government is shutting things down and things of that sort. And then the fact that the civil authorities, one of the things that kind of flabbergasted me through the whole thing is that you actually had mayors, let alone governors, but you had mayors suspending people's right of assembly, constitutional rights, which was a little bit alarming. And then you also have then, of course, the situation in the church in which, by and large, the bishops just simply rolled over and not only did what the civil authorities asked, but actually did more than what the civil authorities asked. So even in cases such as in Texas, when the civil authorities asked, said, no, you can still go into church, the bishops still shut it down. Some of the bishops still shut it down. So you have a situation where, and then you had bishops who were forbidding their priests to give people last rites and things of that sort. So there was a number of different things. You also just have the general state of the church, which is, by pretty much everybody's account, an unmitigated disaster. And so, there's a lot of questions about that people will often have, do I have to go to Sunday Mass? Do I have to go here in order to, if I can only go to the new Mass, can I just not have to go to Mass and things of that sort? And so you have a lot of questions that people are having that actually deal with prudence. So before we actually get into, before we actually get into these virtues that I mentioned, I want to talk a little bit about prudence. Prudence is the virtue, St. Thomas calls it, or defines it, I think with Aristotle too, the application of right reason to action. And that's how he defines it, and we're going to parse that out a little bit. Sometimes it's defined as the virtue in which, it's in the intellect, in which the person knows the right thing to do at the right time. So he knows the right kind of action to achieve the right end, under the right set of circumstances. Okay, so insofar as it's the application of right reason, we need to talk about this term right reason. Recently, there was a bishop who made the observation that, we need to follow white reason in relationship to this stuff. And somebody ridiculed that term, not knowing that it has an entire history behind it. So obviously it's reason, which is that part, that faculty in us, which has the ability to grasp the truth. Right reason is that which is in conformity with the natural law. That is, that the habits of thinking, the way we judge, it's the way the reason judges, is in accord with the natural law, that is, the structure that God placed in human beings, inclining them to specific kinds of activity, etc. And then the divine positive law. So the natural law is in human nature itself. That is, St. Thomas says the way God promulgated the natural law is by the actual creation of human nature, because in that we're inclined towards specific kinds of activities. The divine positive law is what we receive from revelation. So, for example, the precepts of charity, things of this sort, you know, forgive your neighbor, you know, 70 times is part of divine positive law. So these are, this is what we know, the divine positive law is what we actually know from revelation. Some of what's in the divine positive law is just a revelation of the natural law. So the Ten Commandments are actually God revealing to humanity, this is what you are, this is what you're designed to do, this is what you're not supposed to be doing, and this is what you're supposed to do. So one of the ways we know that is St. Thomas in his Summa Contra Gentiles argues to all of the Ten Commandments based purely on reason without any appeal to revelation. So a lot of times people will say, well, I don't believe in the Ten Commandments because that's in the Bible and blah, 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 blah. But actually, it's actually part of the natural law. It's part of our design. You know, we're not designed to go around lying. We're not designed to go around stealing and things of this sort. Okay, so when you're talking about prudence then, so prudence is the application of right reason to action. And what does that mean in a concretely? It means that this right reason takes the precepts, the principles, and the precepts from the natural law and the divine positive law, and then applies them in action, which is always in the concrete. Okay. So it's the application of the precepts or principles in concrete sets of circumstances. That means that prudence essentially takes three steps. And there's a reason why we're getting into this, because this helps people to have a more moderated view of how things are to be judged, especially when we get to the virtue of nome. Okay, so since it's right reason, reason is the process by which I go from premise to premise to conclusion. So it's a process, it's syllogistic in a certain sense, but it's a process in which I start with certain premises and ideas, and then I conclude certain things from them. I draw certain conclusions. So St. Thomas talks about, and the subsequent authors talk about what they call the practical syllogism, which basically the major premise, the major premise is some precept or principle. So for example, thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not steal. Okay. That's a general principle. We're going to talk about these principles a little bit later. But it's a general principle. It applies everywhere and in all cases, right? Because what happens is people say, well, what if you're starving and you need the food and you just go and take only what you need? And, well, technically speaking, that's not an act of stealing. So, okay. So, thou shalt not steal applies everywhere in all cases. Another one that applies everywhere in all cases, thou shalt not commit adultery. It's thou shalt not have false gods before me. So all of the Ten Commandments apply everywhere and in all circumstances. Okay. The minor premise is, okay, this is a general idea, a general principle, but to actually know that in this particular case, I shouldn't steal. So an example I give is, and this is something that's important because you actually have to know the circumstances. So before you can actually judge what's the right thing to do. So an example I often give is, if you see a black woman taking a purse from an elderly white woman on the streets of New York, morally, what is that? And people almost always say, it's theft. Well, the fact of the matter is, you don't know that. It might be his purse, given the way people are today. It might be his purse. And I've seen some pretty curmudgeonly old ladies that might have stole the guy's purse, right? So you can't say that that's theft. Why? Because you actually have to know what? The condition of the purse first. So you got to know what's going on. You got to know the concrete circumstances before you can actually judge that, you know, this is an act of theft. Now, we also know that in relationship to just our own, like if we go to a to some place where we, like if we're in a competition of some sort, and we've put the thing that's competing out there, right? We might leave for a while and then come back, and we have a moral claim to that particular thing because we actually own it. And because I know in the circumstances that this is my, you know, a friend of mine actually, every time he's ever entered beer at one of these state fairs, he's always won. I said, well, that's pretty impressive. He says, not really, if you consider the fact that there's only two other people competing with me. So, but anyway, the point being is that you know that that's my beer, right? So, and as a result of that, if he takes the beer, he knows it's not an act of theft. So the minor premises are actually the circumstances. So in this particular case, thou shalt not steal. So in this particular case, the circumstance is this is not my property. If you're talking about, you know, this beer doesn't belong to me. This beer does, but this one doesn't. So the circumstance is not my property. And so the conclusion is don't take the beer. Okay, not my property or beer. Okay, don't take the beer is the conclusion that a person arrives at intellectually. So this is a process. So what does this mean? It means that the general principles or precepts are applied in the concrete, that is through the circumstances, to arrive at a specific kind of activity that I'm going to perform. Okay. This means, therefore, that which principle applies in the concrete is the result of the circumstances. What does that mean? Okay. So in the case of the property, it's because it's not my property that the precept that forbids theft even applies. If we're talking about my beer, the precept that thou shalt not commit adultery doesn't apply because it's not, we're not talking about the relationship that a particular individual has to a woman or not. We're talking about the relationship that the beer has to the individual. Okay, so it's the circumstances that determine which principle actually ends up applying, right? So then of these circumstances, there's different kinds of cases. So you can have case A, let's take the case. So let's take a precept. So this is the thou shalt not steal is one of those precepts that applies everywhere and in all cases. So anytime you have a situation where it's theft, everywhere you have it, and in every single case, it applies. You can't steal, period, okay? So, but then there are certain ones in which, so if you take the precepts that that you have to have the obligation to fraternally correct. Okay, so we have an obligation to fraternally correct those around us. Okay. That, St. Thomas says, does not apply everywhere and in all cases, but is actually mediated even more so by the circumstance. So the circumstance will determine which principle applies, and if it's a principle that applies everywhere in all cases, then you know it can never be done. In this, like such as in the case of theft. If it's something that applies mediating the circumstances, then the circumstances determine how and if that principle actually ends up applying. So, for example, in the case of fraternal correction, in that particular case, if you have somebody who is open to the correction, and all other things being equal, then we would have it not because of the circumstances that the person's open to the correction, then I have an obligation to fraternally correct. Therefore, I should correct this person. On the other hand, if it's clear that the person is closed to fraternal correction, then in order to not result in the situation being worse, because of the circumstances that I'm going to end up making this thing worse, then I don't actually apply the general precept of fraternal correction in this particular case. I don't correct them. Okay. So this is an important discussion that there are some precepts that apply everywhere in all cases. And then there are certain precepts that apply mediating the circumstances. That is, sometimes they apply, sometimes they don't. Sometimes, even if it is a case of somebody doing something wrong and they should be, they need corrected, it may not be, I may not be the one to correct them, because one of the circumstances is, you know, if it's somebody that I have aggravated my whole life, if I go and correct them, it's just going to make it worse. Whereas somebody else could just come up and say, hey, would you stop this? The person will stop. So the circumstances will determine which person should correct, who shouldn't, etc. Okay. So prudence is applying these principles in the concrete. This is the action I'm supposed to perform. Okay. So, and that's what prudence does. Now, I want to talk a little bit about something which is going to help, especially when we get to the discussion about things like situation in the church and in the world. So, since prudence is applying the universal principle in the concrete, we want to talk a little bit about, which some of you have seen me talk about this. You're probably tired of it, but that's okay. All right. We have five senses. And those senses, taste, touch, hearing, smell, etc., they're unified into a coherent image. St. Thomas calls it a phantasm. It's unified together by what's called the common sense power. And it's expressed into the imagination. It's contemporaneously pressed into memory. Then once the image gets into the imagination, by the way, this is all done at the level of what's material. It's basically the brain performing this function. Actually, technically, it's the soul acting through the brain, St. Thomas says. So what happens is, so then once this image comes into the imagination, there's the cogitative power, goes back into memory, finds the images that are similar or have aspects of it that are similar, and brings that information back into and merges it with the image. So it prepares the image. Okay. Part of the cogitative power, it has three actions. One is just association and disassociating. You know, this is or this isn't like the other thing. The other one is it makes an assessment about whether it's good or bad purely on a physical level. So, you know, if you've had a really good experience with chocolate in the past, then when you see chocolate, it's going to make the association of this is really good to taste, right? It's going to make that assessment that this is good purely on a taste level or on a physical level. And then the last thing it does, it prepares for abstraction. The image for abstraction. Okay. This assessment, once it determines that it's good or bad on a purely physical level, it puts that perspective that it's good or bad is merged with the image, and that's what moves the emotions. Okay, so we have appetites. So once the appetites see that this thing is actually really good, chocolate, then the person has the desire, the emotion of desire for the chocolate, right? So it moves towards that. So the emotions are moved by what's in the imagination. Now, so two things actually end up happening, however, is once the experience of the thing comes in through the senses, we get an image of it, and then the cognitive power makes the association, and then the emotions move in relationship to it. That experience of the emotion is then merged back with the image. I sense or experience having the emotion in relationship to the thing. So the emotion of desire means that I think this thing is good, and so in addition to just having a perspective on the image that I think this thing is good, now I have the inclination of the motion to the thing being good. Okay. Then, I'm not going to get too much into it. We have a part of the intellect that abstracts from this image, a concept that's placed in the what St. Thomas calls the possible intellect. This is the immaterial part. This is the part, it's purely immaterial. It has, these are activities that occur independently of a bodily organ. So I have the concept is pressed into the possible intellect by the agent intellect, and then that's when I have an act of understanding. Then the possible intellect looks at the concept in it, and then goes back and looks at the image to make a comparison of the two, and that's called judgment. I make an act of judgment. So, for example, I have the concept of goat. I look back and I see that goats are, generally speaking, four-footed. So I can come up with the judgment of goats are four-footed. Right? Okay. But I also, these judgments also have to do with what's morally right and wrong. And this is on a moral level. Whereas this good or bad is actually on a purely physical level. That judgment of being morally right or wrong in the intellect is then presented to the will. The will makes a choice, and then it can either move the intellect to consider other things or it can move the other faculties. Okay. Why is this important? Where is truth? Truth is when the possible intellect looks at the concepts and looks in the imagination and makes a judgment about the relationship of those two things. Why? Because the image is what puts me in contact with reality. So if I want to actually know that goats are four-footed, it's not just something that I can imagine and think what I want. No, I got to look at reality. I have to be in contact with reality through my senses, and then I have to have the right image. I actually have to have images. If all I ever saw were paintings of goats with 3 feet, I would not know that goats are in reality four-footed. And so what can happen is my image can actually be falsified. The emotions, and then as a result, when I make the judgment, I don't know the truth about it. I think that goats are four or three-footed. Okay. Now, so when you do this, why is this so important? Because St. Thomas says that truth lies in a mean between excess and defect. So the truth is that goats are four-footed. They're not five-footed, and they're not three-footed. They're four-footed, okay? This is also true in relationship to judging whether something's morally good or not. People tend to think something's morally good when a lot of times their emotions or their past experience of it is good on that kind of level. So what does this concretely mean? It means when the emotions move and that experience of emotion gets moved with the image of the phantasm, what happens is the emotion draws my judgment of the truth either to excess, if I think, well, this is much better than it actually is, or I actually think it's not good. I think it's actually worse than it actually is. So, for example, if you want to see a perfect example of this, just tell somebody, you know, what you really need to do is you need to start doing mortification, or you need to start working on the virtue in which you embrace your cross. You need to get to the point where, you know, that you suffer well. Just saying those things, the first thing that's going to happen is the cogitative power is going to go back and realize that, hey, in the past, suffering was physically bad. And so as a result of that, the emotion of ultimately hatred, where you turn away from the thing, or flight, where you turn away, where you flee from the actual thing, gets merged with the image, and the first initial reaction of the person on the lower faculties is, this isn't good. And so what happens is when it makes a judgment, the person says, this isn't good. So in other words, it draws suffering isn't as bad as people think, generally speaking. And so what they tend to do is go to the defect. I don't want to suffer this thing, or I shouldn't have to suffer this much, or I'm only going to engage in a mortification to this degree rather than what I really need to. So what that basically means is that the emotions precipitate our judgment and draw us into falsity. That's what if you get on the blogs, or if you get on the internet and you read people's discussion in the fora, In the various forums, or if you go to just seeing people, you know, if you they have post a story and you just read people's comments about it, people are just completely at the point in which instead of the judgment, where by the way, once you make a judgment through the will, you can move the imagination to change your image and as a result change your emotional response. Okay, so instead of the emotions following reason, what we have today is the reason is just simply following the emotions all the time. So people, you'll see people's reaction are literally becoming unhinged. They're just this visceral response, etc. Why is this important? It means when you're looking at the state of the church and when you're looking at what, you know, how do we deal with this stuff that's going on in the church, and you're looking at the state of the world and how to deal with it, if you are having any emotional response, what they call antecedent emotion, which is what occurs before reason actually has a chance to make a judgment, or that it's contrary to judgment, or that you're not being able to think of the thing clearly, because what does emotions do? What they do is by inclining to these particular things and then getting merged with the imagination, it holds the lower faculties somewhat captive, so it's hard to think clearly about it or to think freely in a certain sense because you keep getting drugged back to how bad everything is, etc., or whatever the case is. So what this basically means is if you are not able to look at the state of the church and the state of the world without any emotion whatsoever, it's a sign that your judgment's being drugged to excess or defect. That's one of the signs. And you have to get your head completely cleared and be able to think. We say you have to think of the thing objectively, which really means what? I'm looking at I'm making judgments about my image that's rooted in reality, not in my emotional response to the reality. Because that's what the emotions do. They jade the perspective of the reality of the situation. So the more you follow your emotions, the more you're just going to get disconnected from reality. So you have to put all emotion aside and just look at the thing objectively, okay, if you're going to do it right. Now, that means that imprudence, if I'm going to act prudently, two things are absolute, well, actually three things, are absolutely necessary. The first is in the possible intellect. This is where we understand universals, you know, like thou shalt not steal. I have to actually have knowledge. We'll see this becomes a big problem later for some people. You have to have knowledge of the general principles or precepts. So that's the first thing you have to have. This is why kids today who have never been taught that theft is immoral go and steal, right? So this was about three or four years ago. They did a polling of kids between the ages of, I think it was 18 and 22. No, sorry, take that back. It was 14 and 18. And 80% of them had admitted they had stolen something in the last month. Right? And you're just like, wow, that's pretty bad. I'm not sure what the demographics of that polling data were, but it sounds pretty bad. The point being is that when you're not trained to see this as bad, when you don't understand that stealing is immoral, then you're likely to steal. So you're not going to be able to apply those things properly in the concrete. So the first thing you have to know, so if you look at that syllogism, the first thing you have to know is the general precept. The second thing is you have to have sufficient virtue in order so that your grasp of the circumstances is clear-headed. What does that mean? The reality is where the circumstances are. That's how I know what's going on. What are the circumstances of this situation? Well, it's reality. It's not what I think or want to think. That is completely irrelevant when it comes to the circumstances. What it ultimately boils down to is what are the circumstances, which is what's the reality of this situation. That is known through the image, and that means that I have to have a clear image, and that means that my emotions have to be under control. And what gets the appetites and the emotions under control is called virtue. So the person who has, say, the virtue of temperance, when he sees chocolate, his emotions aren't immediately moved to the chocolate. He has no emotional response. And then later he can think about it through an act of judgment or reason, and then he puts a perspective on the image of, you know, this chocolate would be really good for me right now. And then the emotion desire will arise, right? That's how that's supposed to actually work. Okay, so virtue gets the antecedent emotions, that emotional response before or contrary to reason. It gets that under control and gets it subordinated to reason. So you have to have sufficient virtue, okay? So you have to have the general knowledge of the general precepts. You have to have clear images, which comes through sufficient virtue. This is one of the reasons why, even when people know the general principles, when you start talking to them about, a perfect example is in the area of sedificantism, the discussion of sedificantism. The minute you start telling people, you know, they know that Christ said that the church of gates will not prevail against them. And they know that that means that the essential structure of the church will continue to exist. And they know that means that the hierarchy structure is an essential part of the church, and therefore it will never end, which means that we cannot go more than a generation without a pope, right? So they know that intellectually. But emotionally, their experience in their reading of and their judgment of the pope is so bad that they can't reconcile these two particular things, and so their judgment emotionally tends to drag them to excess or defect, depending on what they're actually judging in relationship to it. So this is why virtue is sufficient just to even know the reality of the situation. Okay. Then the third thing is, and this is something which I'm starting to become more alarmed. I used to not talk too much about this third part too much. But that is, you have to be able to know how to draw legitimate conclusions from the premises. You know, so, and this is something that started alarming me. I noticed that certain millennials, and even some of the younger kids now coming up, if you say all A are B and all B are C, they'll say, yeah, yeah, okay, okay. And then you say, therefore, all A are C, you will get this visceral response, and they're like, no, that's not true, you can't say that, blah, 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 blah. In other words, they can't see that one thing literally follows from another, and therefore it's true, and so you have to follow regardless of what your emotional response is. Another thing that you'll actually see is they're even incapable. Like you'll say, all A or B, all B or C, and therefore all A are C. And they're like, how did you get that? Where did you come up with that idea? And you're just like, literally because why? The formation they're receiving in public education right now is bits of information in order to elicit emotional responses. That's what they're actually training kids to do. They're not training kids to think syllogistically or logically. And so they literally can't think that way because of the fact that they've been so habituated intellectually in the intellect that they can't make the proper judgments, because to draw a conclusion is actually a judgment. Okay. So this is an important point, because anytime you're analyzing, okay, what do we do, you know, in the state of the church right now? And we'll see this becomes really important when we get to the virtue of nome. You really have to have sufficient virtue, and you have to have clear images or phantasms in order to judge the reality of the situation, so that you can have a metered response to the thing rather than just viscerally reacting. Okay. So the first virtue I want to talk about then in relationship to prudence. So this is the backdrop. If I'm going to act prudently, I have to know the precepts. I have to have sufficient virtue so that my emotions are under control, and that I have the proper images, and I have the proper experience to have the proper images, and then I have to be able to know how to draw those proper conclusions if I'm just going to act prudently, right? So that's a key. Now, this, the sufficient virtue is really important, because remember, it's through the image. It's through the image that I know the circumstances. What does that mean concretely? The circumstances tell me which principle applies. If I don't have clear images because I'm an emotional wreck, or I'm relating to this thing emotionally, it means I'm not going to apply the right principles, or I'm going to apply the right principle in the wrong way. And that's a very key issue that you're seeing people today on, especially in the Catholic sphere, when they're talking about the state of the church, you know, even what the bishops are doing and things of that sort. Okay. So this applying, so right prudence is applying, it's right reason applied to action. Okay. So St. Thomas says there's two virtues that basically help to govern prudence.
And those two virtues are, the first one is called synesis. It's a Greek term.
There's no English equivalent because it's only used so rarely in this distinction that you only really see it in technical moral manuals and usually in Latin. I think I've only seen this term once or twice in English. But that's how they just transliterate. So it's synesis. So synesis is the virtue, St. Thomas says, in which I know when the precepts of the law applies commonly, he says. What does that mean? He says, this is the virtue which helps me to know that the common precept of thou shalt not steal applies in this case. So it's the virtue in which I know when the common law actually applies. Okay, that's a really key point. So this is the virtue which helps me to know this is just a case of theft. This is just a case of adultery. This is just a case of fraud. So, you know, a perfect example of where this virtue is completely bereft is when, you know, you will have, people in one of the specific political parties will get caught stuffing ballots into a mailbox, and they just insist that that's not fraud. They just insist that there's nothing wrong with that or what have you. Or that, and so instead of, you know, and the common law is thou shalt not commit fraud, right? Which is, and so they just basically deny, they basically act like this is a non-issue, right? Or they go and the law forbids a particular thing. They'll go out in public and do that very thing, and somehow or another, they don't think the law applies to them. That is a sign that they don't even have synesis, which is a sign of a mental breakdown, frankly. When you don't even know when basic laws apply, that commonly apply, that everybody knows this is what the law is and this is how it applies, and you basically either deny it, which I really think is they know it applies, but they're just denying it in most cases. But if they don't actually think it applies to them specifically, that's a sign of mental illness that they've gotten to that stage. This is the most fundamental and easiest thing that any human being should be able to do on a basic level. Okay. So this is the virtue which know that by which I know which when the common law applies and basically which law applies in this particular case. So, you know, if I'm standing on the street corner and I see that this elderly woman has a Gucci, I think that's what they're called, purse, and I realize that's worth a lot of money. So I decide I'm gonna take that from her. I know that I'm committing theft, right? Because I know that that's her purse. It's not my purse. Okay. So this is something that is key. The next virtue is nome. And nome has a few aspects to it, which I think would be good to discuss. It pertains to nome to have right judgment of those things in which the law fails. The term there in Latin is deficit, which means it doesn't obtain or it just doesn't actually occur, which has a special difficulty in which it is directed by epikaia. Okay, we're going to parse that out here in just a minute. Hence, nome, according to Aristotle, is the right judgment of epikaia. Okay, so what does that actually mean? It means that there are certain, so the circumstances tell me that this is which law commonly applies. And so by commonly applies means that in 99.9% of the cases, there's going to be a law that simply applies, a precept that applies, and you know you're not supposed to do that, right? Or you are supposed to do it, one of the two. But in that very small percentage of cases, you'll have circumstances that fall outside the scope of what the law actually envisions. So, for example, you know, they put up a speed limit that says 30 miles an hour, right? And we're not talking about going through a crowded school zone. We're just, you know, it's, and so we know that you're supposed to drive 30 miles an hour. But if somebody is dying and you're trying to get them to the hospital, it's generally understood that the law, which normally applies, doesn't apply in that particular case because of the fact that the circumstances, that law didn't envision, you know, that if someone's dying, you just take your sweet time getting to the hospital. It doesn't envision that. And so you can set the law aside and drive a reasonable speed, right? So we'll talk about how that's governed in a minute. So nome is the virtue in which, it's part of prudence, in which I realize these circumstances, there's not a common law applies, and therefore it's the virtue in which I know the right thing to do when the common laws do not apply. This is where we're at today. We're not living in normal circumstances. The fact that we were under a lockdown, the fact that the government is basically set aside constitutional rights and behaving badly and doing whatever they please and being dictatorial in various pockets and locations. The fact that, by and large, actually I've been squawking that the Constitution hasn't been being followed for years, which is true, it hasn't. But the point is that now it's even particularly worse. And so then the question becomes, what are people supposed to do? You know, when the government, another example is telling people that they have to wear a mask in their own home, right? And this is a situation in which you're like, well, first of all, the state can't really tell you to wear a mask within your own home because of the nature of the mask and the nature of the circumstances and the limits of the mask, et cetera, and all that really calls into question that judgment. Especially when it's done by people that appear, I'm not saying they are necessarily, but they appear to basically doing a power grab and things of that sort. So you have this scenario where they're basically telling people to do stuff that, well, you don't even have the right or the authority to even tell me to do that, etc. So then you have a situation in which you have a law or a civil law or something in which is being promulgated, but the person doesn't have the authority to do. So this is not a normal circumstance. What do you do in that case? Right. So that's what we're talking about. In the church, then you have the other side of the problem, which is, and I'm open to correction about this. I'm trying to find something that actually gives the bishops, I think they're doing it in a back kind of handed way where it says, in canon law that they can basically dispense people from the Sunday observance, you know, the obligation, Sunday obligation. But my understanding is at least historically, my understanding was, is that that always basically applied in individual cases or in small groups. It didn't apply to their entire diocese. Or the fact that, practically speaking, they didn't do it juridically, but practically speaking, when the lockdown came down, they essentially suspended ad divinis. Virtually all the priests in the diocese were essentially suspended ad divinis, at least by degree. And so you have this scenario where you're like, I don't know if a bishop can even do that, right? So, okay, so that being the case, when you have circumstances that are just not normal, where bishops are literally telling all the priests in the diocese you cannot say public mass, what do you do in a set of circumstances like that? Okay. So that's what this virtue does. Synesis tells me what to do on the day-to-day normal life. Nome tells me to do, what do you do when you come across circumstances that are just not what fall within the normal view of the law? So it's the circumstances that tell me whether synesis or nome applies. Both deal with the means to the end because they're both dealing with action. What do I do in this particular case achieve the right end? St. Thomas says that synesis and nome judge according to diverse rules. Now, the term here in Latin is regula, or regulus, because it's in the plural, but it's regula, which basically means a regula is something that regulates, moderates, or directs a thing, and it basically governs it in a certain sense. He says, for synesis is judicative of things to be done according to the common law, which we've talked about, and nome according to the natural reason itself. Now, there's the first indication of what we do when things don't seem to stack up. Nome according to the natural reason itself in those things in which the common law fails. By fails, it means it just doesn't seem to extend to it. So what happens is the circumstances result in the common law not applying. So one has to shift, therefore, so remember, so in prudence, what do I do? I take the law, which is the precept, Look at the circumstances and apply the precept in the concrete. That's what I'm doing prudentially. What do I do when there's not a precept? What do I do when there's no precept in this because the circumstances basically don't line up with the nature of any kind of precept? What do I do? Okay. And that's where we see St. Thomas actually gives us at least initial indication. Natural reason itself. It's what reason dictates. We'll see what that means concretely here in a minute. He says, it sometimes happens that some thing is to be done aside from the common rules of acting. For example, when in the case of the enemy of one's country, when it would be wrong to give him back his deposit or something of this kind. Now, this is kind of a common example that they will use, more or less we use. So, for example, normally speaking, if someone has said, hey, I need you to keep my gun, right, safe, and when I need it, I'll come back and I'll get it, right? And you say, okay, because it's his property, right? So your job is just to watch over the thing, right? So then he comes back. Under normal circumstances, you just give him his gun back. But when he comes up, you see he's got this murderous rage on his thing and he's talking about blowing his wife's head off. You don't give him his gun back, right? So this is the point that we're actually, under normal circumstances, commonly speaking, you would just give him his gun back. But in that particular case, you don't give it back. And therefore, it is necessary to judge according to some higher principles than the common rules. Now here again, it's regula, those things that is the general precepts and principles, general. According to which synesis judges, it is necessary that a higher virtue of judgment judge according to a higher virtue of judgment, which is called nome, which applies a certain perspicacity of judgment. In other words, nome is a higher virtue than synesis because it doesn't follow just basic precepts which are at the lowest level. It follows a set of principles that are higher than that, right? And what does that mean? These higher principles we're going to see are those from which the precepts are derived. But the principles are more extensive, they're more universal than the actual precepts, okay? With the exception of the ones which God can bring about. So De Ferrari, he was the guy that had compiled the Dictionary of St. Thomas, which is one of the most useful things if you're ever going to read St. Thomas in Latin. He says, he defines nome as an aptitude or ability to judge rightly in the extraordinary things of life. In other words, it's extraordinary in two senses. One is it doesn't happen commonly, and which means it's rare. And it's above and beyond what you would normally have to deal with. Sometimes it happens to a person that the circumstances in which he finds himself are out of the ordinary and not common, and so the virtue of nome helps him to judge what is to be done according to higher principles. In the Prima Secundi, St. Thomas indicates that the higher principles are the natural law itself, natural reason. Okay, what does that mean? God, in making human beings, designed their reason. He structured it a certain way so that we would actually have specific kinds of thinking patterns. And so he designed it a certain way, and so the natural law basically means what? That one of the higher principles of the natural law in relationship to reason is this structure that he put into reason. So that's why St. Thomas says it's following natural reason, which really means what? Right reason. Okay, what's right reason? That which is in accord with the natural law and the divine positive law. So in cases of nome, where you have to know, what do I do in a case like this? Because there doesn't seem to be a precept that seems to apply, or the normal precept that normally applies isn't applying in this particular case, then what you do is you have to step back and look at the principles which are behind the precept, or the principles which govern our basic behavior, and those are going to tell me what I need to do in this particular case. I'll make it concrete so it'll be clear as we go along. If a man has a knowledge of the three categories of natural inclination, so in the natural law, there's three categories of natural inclination. The first is the preservation of our being as it is. This is why we don't kill ourselves and we don't go around chopping our fingers off, unless we lose our use of reason. The second is that which we have in common with other animals, bearing and rearing of children primarily. food, eating, things of that sort. The third is that which is proper to the life of reason. This includes government, social interaction, and things of this sort. So if you have a knowledge of these three categories of natural inclination and what falls under each one of those categories, the person will have the ability to know what should be done in extraordinary circumstances. In other words, in every single set of circumstances, there's always some principle applies which tells me what to do. The precepts, there may not be some type of formal precept that I would know, but reason will tell me, based on principle, this principle is applying in this particular case. We'll see this when we talk about, going to Mass and things of that sort. On the other hand, some who are very bright and have a decent grasp of human nature. So the first kind of individual is a person who actually understands the natural law, studied it formally, and he actually knows how to apply it. The second is a person who's really bright and has a decent grasp of human nature, and therefore, in a certain sense, he kind of knows, well, this is the way human beings are designed. He'll probably know what to do in extraordinary circumstances. In order to be proficient in nome requires also an in-depth knowledge of the divine positive law to some degree. That you have to know it in depth to some degree. Without that, referring to the higher principles will not that is such, be a following of emotion. Okay, what does this mean? Okay, so because in prudence, looking at the precept, I look at the circumstances, and then I know what to do. This process, of course, the circumstances tell me which precept applies, and most circumstances are normal, but then you're going to get circumstances in which there hasn't been a formulated precept that's going to tell me what to do. All precepts, and this will be helpful, are derived from moral principles. And these moral principles, there are some that apply everywhere, in all cases, regardless of the circumstances. Regardless, even if the circumstances are a little wacky. So, for example, one of them is do good and avoid evil. That applies everywhere and in all circumstances, regardless. Doesn't matter if the circumstances are extraordinary. You can never do evil to achieve good, etc. Okay, which is one of the principles derived from that. The other one is God is to be obeyed. This is going to become really important when we start discussing what do you do in this situation in the church, or when the civil authorities start telling you you have to do X, Y, and Z. Normally speaking, we simply obey the civil authorities and obey when they're doing things normally, because that's the common law, is you obey the authorities, right? You obey the civil authorities and you obey the church. But we're not exactly in that set of circumstances right now. Okay. Now, these moral principles come from the natural law and the divine positive law. So once you actually study the divine positive law, you realize there are certain principles. And we actually see this God is to be obeyed actually takes a specific form when St. Paul, although I'm open to correction on that, said we are to obey God rather than men. So if men start telling us to do something which is contrary to the laws of God, the precepts, this is a set of circumstances that's outside the normal circumstances, then the normal precept is the civil authorities are to be obeyed, because all authority comes from God, as Leo XIII said. Okay, so that being, and actually it's even in scripture. So that being the case, you normally just follow the civil authorities when they tell you legitimately what to do. But when they start telling you stuff that's contrary to God's law, then you shift back to this principle. God is to be obeyed, which is part of the natural law and divine positive law, because it's revealed there too. But it's divine positive law, and the divine positive law states that you obey God rather than men. The only reason you're obeying men is because you're obeying God, okay? Whereas the natural law also knows that as well. So what you have to do is, when the circumstances don't tell me the precept, I have to shift back to one of these principles, and that which principles apply will be determined by the circumstances. If I have the use of right reason, I know that, okay, look, the civil authority is telling me, that I have to do something immoral. That means, no, I have to obey God's law above the civil authorities, and so that's what I do. That's outside the normal circumstances. But that's what Nome shows me to do in this particular case, is that, no, I have to obey God more than civil authorities. Another moral principle is that authority is in a hierarchy. And who's ever higher in the hierarchy has greater authority and therefore can contravene the lower authority. That means that if the civil authorities tell me to do something that's contrary to church law or contrary to church teaching, I shift away from that and I actually follow the church's ruling over the civil authorities. Okay. Although today the civil authorities think that they have the right to rule and tell the church what to think and do. Okay. So this, what will happen is if you don't have an understanding of the natural law and the divine positive law and these principles, what's likely to happen is when a person judges what to do, the circumstances will elicit a specific emotional response and one will simply follow one's emotions. That's usually what happens 99% of the time in relationship to people. Whereas if you understand these things, reason can kind of contravene the emotional response very often, or at least look at the thing more objectively. So the more you understand these things, the easier it is to actually understand what to do. Now, in the next conference, I'm going to talk about confusion. But I want to just say a little bit about this right now. The definition of confusion is when two or more contraries exist in the intellect at the same time. That's the definition of confusion. Okay. So what happens is once you understand the various levels of precepts, nome and synesis, once you understand the various level of precepts, which takes precedence over which will derive from the natural law, when the circumstances don't apply, what do you actually do, etc., all of the confusion evaporates because you're not having contraries exist in your mind because of the fact that you know that way people get into contradiction, well, I'm supposed to obey the civil authorities, but they're telling me to do X, which is immoral. That's the contradiction. Well, you only obey the civil authorities as long as they're not contravening morality. So if they contravene morality, then you just disregard it. That's the principle. The civil authorities, they're not an absolute. And why is that? St. Thomas says that God is the only one that can derive a principle or a precept, enunciate a precept which applies everywhere and in all cases. All human laws, all human precepts never bind everywhere and in all cases. Why? Because he says, human beings do not know the infinite number of various circumstances that could possibly arise in order to be able to formulate a precept that would cover all those circumstances, whereas God does. So God's precepts apply everywhere in all cases, or some of them do at least, that he's enunciated. So like, thou shalt not commit adultery applies everywhere in all cases. Whereas human things like, that you have to stop at a stop sign, that may not apply in certain circumstances. Very rarely, it does commonly, but not in all circumstances. Okay. So then, it's nome which, and that's the knowledge of these things, it's nome which gives me the virtue in which I'm able to quickly from the circumstances know which principles apply and how to apply them in these kinds of circumstances. So today when people are looking at, how weird things are getting and they're just like, what do we do? It's a sign they don't have nome. Because if they had nome, they would just immediately know and say, okay, this is what we're supposed to do. Now, the precepts, another name for a precept is law. Okay. Although they have somewhat different connotations, they are basically laws. Okay. So St. Thomas observes that. We noticed earlier, he says that the right thing to do based upon the divine positive natural law, based upon what the mind of the legislator is. In Latin, the phrase is mens legislatoris. And this is an important point. This has completely broken down in our society. people are interpreting the laws now completely contrary to the mind of the legislators that actually put them out. Okay. And you even see this now in the church when God said, you know, you shalt not do X, Y, and Z. And now people are saying, well, yeah, but you can still do Z because of, you know, J, Y, and K, when that's not the mind of God at all. So the mind of the legislator means that when he formulates a law or a precept, there's an intention behind it. He's inclining people through this law to perform certain actions or avoid others. And there is a reason why he's doing that. So for example, the reason you don't allow adultery is because it destroys families, it has a deleterious effect on the children, etc. Okay. So that's the mind of God behind that. In relationship to the speed limit, the mind of the civil authorities, generally speaking, is to regulate speed so that people can get to a place relatively quickly, but at the same time, safety being preserved, right? So that's kind of the mind behind it. So that's why I said that, you know, if someone's dying, then you can drive faster than the speed limit, but you still have to be considered what? You have to look at the mind of the legislator. What is that? Safety. So you don't drive, you know, 300 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone. You might drive like 45 or 50 or something like that instead, because you might be hypervigilant, et cetera, under those circumstances, which would be very rarely. So that's kind of the mind. You have to look at the mind of the legislator. I still have to preserve people's safety in that process. Okay. The virtue that helps me know the mind of the legislator is called epikaya. It's spelled a couple of different ways in English, but that's it. This is right judgment when the law fails. Now, what does this mean? This is the law, this is the virtue which tells me that the common law isn't applying. It's different from nome. We'll see that here in a minute. This is the one that helps me know what the mind of the legislator is when the common law doesn't apply. So St. Thomas defines it as when one follows the intention of the legislator aside from his law, aside from the law. And he says, in some cases, it is contrary to the equality of justice that one would apply the common law. And it is contrary to the common good which the law intends. So he says, therefore you do something different. So for example, normally speaking, in applying the, say a penal law to somebody, you know, if somebody has stolen something and the common law says, you know, that you know you can't steal these particular things, etc. And if you steal Gucci purses, there's a greater penalty for it because for some reason or other everyone's stealing those, you know, in our scenario. And so as a result, in order to get that down, you increase the penalty of it in order to kind of get it under. He would say that in certain circumstances, say someone who stole it who is extremely poor, they could still kind of survive, but they're extremely poor. You might mitigate the law a little bit and set it aside because the mind of the legislator is the good of the common good of the society, and that common good of the society would be deteriorated if we're just hammering poor people all the time. Okay. Nome is knowing what to do in the practical application. Epikaya is about knowing what the mind of the legislator is regarding the law when it doesn't apply. Okay, so that's two different things. Nome is knowing what to do in the practical application. Concretely, this is what I'm supposed to do. Whereas epikaya is knowing what the mind of the legislator is aside from his law or common law. In the end, epikaya is about suitability. It's knowing that the legislator, his mind was to get the stealing of Gucci purses under control, right? And so you notice and also in order to secure the common good. And so as a result of that, you might mitigate it in a circumstance which kind of falls outside that the scope of thing in which the legislator just didn't quite have it in mind. Okay. So that being the case, then we want to talk about a few things in relationship to the state and the church. I'm not going to get into all of them. but we're going to talk a little bit about them, and then we can open it up for questions. The bishops, in relationship to authority, we're going to talk a little bit about this later, but in relationship to authority, it's limited. They don't have absolute authority, and so if they tell you to do something contrary to divine law, you are not bound to follow them. It doesn't mean, therefore, that you can do whatever you want. It means that you must shift to higher principles in order to know what to do. Now, there is, I'm going to give one kind of a thing in which there's kind of a nome situation. So the common law is that we have an obligation, the Sunday obligation. We have to go to Mass on Sunday, right? And that's our common obligation. Now, the church has always known that that doesn't apply everywhere in all cases. So in the past, they said if you're 60 miles or more from the place in which Mass occurs, you're not obligated to go to Mass, right? Now, what people have been doing, and this is a sign that they don't even know, they don't even have synesis. What they'll do is because they don't want to go to Mass, they'll plan their vacation so that they end up in the mountains, that's like 10 hours from the closest church, and they'll just say, well, I'm not obligated to go to Mass. Well, yeah, okay, wait a minute. You should have rearranged it in that. We're talking about a situation where, you know, you come sick, or where you're living and where you have to live, it's a sufficient distance away from the location to where it is. That, you know, the time, today we tend to not think of so much in miles, but in terms of time. So some moralists say, you know, if it's 2 hours or more, you're not obligated to go. Some say if it's an hour or more, you're not obligated to go. So go to Mass. But that means, therefore, that it shifts to higher principles, which basically means what? Well, that doesn't mean, therefore, that I can just disregard Sunday altogether. I still have to keep it holy. I should be doing something else. Okay. An example in which the common law ceased applying was that you had an obligation to go. There was a guy who lived I think it was about 20 miles from this one church. And he kept taking him and his kids to this church until during the Mass, the priest, there was already problems that were starting to happen. The way the guy was preaching was bad, and he was saying a lot of things that were just not true. And so things were starting to degrade. And so at a certain point, the priest, was giving a homily on the Eucharist and told everybody that after the consecration, he was going to have a dance with Jesus. And everyone's like, yeah, okay, whatever that means. So, because this guy was a little strange. After the consecration, he took the host on his head and danced around the sanctuary. Okay. So I said to him, I said, now the common law is that you have to go to Sunday Mass. However, in a situation like that, I told him, you have an obligation to keep your children from seeing that kind of thing. And so he actually did a more meritorious thing. He actually drove to another town, which was 200 miles away, and started going to Mass there. But the point is that he would not have an obligation to take his children to Mass there, or he himself even to go to Mass, if it's going to have a grave effect on his spiritual life. And this is that's kind of the point in all that. Okay, so you can have circumstances in which the common law just doesn't apply, right? So, and that's why the church says you have an obligation to go to Mass. Well, if you get sick, then you don't have an obligation to go to Mass. It has to be sufficiently grave, or at least it's danger to other people, because it has to be sufficiently grave. Okay. So we want to talk a little bit about then the just a few things in relationship to the public sector. So that means the authority that the civil authorities have, and even the bishops, is not absolute. It all is governed by principle. You have to know what those principles are to know whether it applies in relationship to the bishop in particular individual cases. And when it's clear that they're telling you to do something that is aside from the normal law, then you actually have to know the higher principles by which to actually judge it. So, for example, if the state were to say that you know, if the church still had its obligation to go to Mass on Sunday, and the state came up and said, without grave cause, said, you know, no, you can't be going to Mass, you can't be congregating, etc., you set aside the civil law and the authority because of the fact that they don't have the right to do so or that it doesn't necessarily apply in this case. And then you follow the higher principles, which is actually the church's law. And even then, there would be prudential matters that would govern that. The point being is that no man is going to tell me what to do in those particular kinds of cases. And I think this is where people just don't particularly have the sufficient virtue, and they don't know the principles well enough to know what to do in the circumstances that have arisen in relationship to our culture and our society. Okay. I'm going to stop there. And does anyone have any questions? It was a bit of a load, but yes.
Okay, my question is revolving about what you said about do good and avoid evil.
Yeah.
So should I avoid evil people?
Oh.
I seem to be surrounded by them for some reason. And no, I know it's my perception, but it's a battle almost, you know.
Well, quite frankly, I think that's, you know, of people who are trying to lead good lives, I think that's the perception of most people, that they're just surrounded by people who are just immoral. People today are vulgar. They're obnoxious in the way they behave with each other. There's a high degree of malice. So instead of, you know, when something happens, instead of trying to stand back and say, okay, what's the best thing to do in this circumstance? They just club people over the head. There's, you know, you go down the litany in this. People are in a bad state right now. People are not virtuous. That's why I told people, you know, the thing that scared me most about Katrina had nothing to do with the damage. It had to do with the fact that it showed us we are not a virtuous nation, because as soon as that thing hit, it degenerated into gang warfare and everything else and pillaging and everything else, which tells you that people just aren't virtuous. Okay, so that being said, basically what it boils down to is that when it comes to evil people, you should basically, you know, Christ says, you know, make friends with the mammon, which basically means that, you know, you should have a certain kind of a, what they call an official, official friendship with them, which basically is, it's a very technical term, which basically means that I have a business relationship with them and I can read with them, just, but outside of that context, I don't have any relationship with them. And so, you know, and so you basically, and even in relationship to business relationships, you have to kind of navigate it to get, try to get the best people that you can, right? So outside that context. So the answer is, should you avoid evil people? Generally speaking, yes, but in our culture, because they're ubiquitous, you have to do it to the point that it's necessary for you to lead, to fulfill your duties or your state in life and to lead a somewhat normal life.
You get confronted with, you know, you confront them with a minor truth and it just is total reaction of, off the walls, like you said.
Yeah, and that's because of the fact that people have, by the media, by their, especially by their education in school, but by the media, people have been conditioned that they judge the truth of a situation, they judge the truth of something based on how they emotionally relate to the thing.
I learned a lot about that first part. That was great.
Yeah, and so what's happened though is that also means, therefore, that when I hear something that I don't emotionally like, then emotionally I should react to extreme in relationship to it. I should not restrain my emotions in relationship to things. So you get these people, you know, you'll just say just this minor thing and you get this just visceral reaction. I'll give you a perfect example. You know, I'm one of the Exorcists as a general rule have come out against Harry Potter because there's certain things in Harry Potter that are very problematic. I mean, numerous things that are very problematic. And we've actually had kids who've become diabolically influenced from reading the stuff. So we're telling people just stay away from it, right? So if you, and I tell people, look, if I were to say to you, you know, the book Catcher in the Rye, maybe we should wait until people are in college before they read that, because there's some things in there that you really need a mature understanding before you're gonna read that book. People would say, you know, okay, they'd give you a reasonable, you know, they'd probably have a reasonable discussion. The minute you say there's problems in Harry Potter, the visceral reaction you get, none of it's reasonable, none of it's reasoned out. It's just literally evisceration in front of you in full scope. And that's a sign that people aren't even thinking rationally. Because why? Because they're attached to the stuff, and so they end up reacting. And ironically, it's usually the parents who teach it, having their kids read it more than it is the kids. Right? So it's the adults that it's really more of the problem than it is with the kids. But the point being is that, yeah, people are really reacting more purely on the level of emotion. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, Aristotle in his book on the rhetoric does a real service in talking about, you know, the masses of people tend to follow their emotions. And so the best thing to do is to not manipulate them, but to use their emotions so that they can judge rightly about things. So you use their emotions to get them to see the truth about a situation so that they can then follow reason. And I think that's, I think that we're in a stage where a lot of that has to be done. It's like recently someone, a priest posted a video where he said certain things, and I said, well, everything he said was true, but he really needed to lay the groundwork before he ever said that. And so, because otherwise, if you don't lay the groundwork so that you get people in the right condition emotionally, when they hear that stuff, they're just going to react in the wrong way. Okay. Anything else? Okay. If you'll kneel, I'll give you a blessing. Benedictio de omnipotentis, patris et filii, et spiritus sanctus, super vos, et in mani et semper. Amen.